This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine, along with financial planner Kevin McKinley. And today we will discuss college students and what they should know about money matters. We will talk about frequent flyer miles programs, and we will find out about some mid-year money moves that we should consider. And as always, answers to your personal finance questions. What money question do you have for Kevin? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Kevin McKinley is a financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money LLC, and today he joins us in our Madison studios. Hello, Kevin.
Hello, Joy.
It is good to have you here in Madison, and are you getting a college student prepared or something?
Actually, I'm working, so I am preparing my own soon-to-be college student for her financial well-being.
Yeah, that's right. And it's pretty soon we will be having the college students storming in here, and you know, kids heading off to college this fall should probably learn a thing or two about their finances. Kevin, why do you say that?
Well, according to a report from HireOne and EverFi, two people who deal with college students and their finances, they survey 42,000 first-year students entering 2 and 4 year schools, and they ask them questions about their spending, their saving, credit cards, loans, and they test not only their knowledge, but they also track their actions as well. And they've done this, the most recent results are for 2014, but they've also done this for the last couple of years as well.
What did the report say?
Almost all of the positive behaviors have declined. Things like checking account balances, balancing the checkbook, finding out their credit score. From 2012 down through 2014, just about everything has declined. One kind of surprising thing, but it makes sense, is students at the two-year schools actually scored higher than those at their four-year schools in terms of not only their knowledge, but also their actions as well and how they manage their financial affairs. Now, that's probably because many of the students are maybe a little older, and or they're more likely to be on their own, so they take more responsibility for their finances as well. And I think some of the decline might actually be the sign of a good thing, because the economy is getting better, people are worrying a little less about their finances, and so therefore they're not paying as much attention to it as they should. However, college students in particular may have a new reason to pay attention to their personal financial affairs.
What's the new reason?
Their actions may start showing up on their FICO score much quickly than they otherwise might have. In the past, if kids had no financial activity, no borrowing whatsoever, they had no score. And that's good, because if they screwed up, it wasn't on there. But it was bad, because if they went to borrow money, there was no score. In the eyes of the lending industry, they didn't really exist. And so now there are new efforts being made by the credit score people to try to put a score together on the habits of younger people and people of lower income status who don't use traditional banking services much. And that's good news for those who demonstrate good habits, but it's bad news for those who might make mistakes due to being young or being inexperienced or lack of money or lack of knowledge.
Boy, I would have been in big trouble. So what should college students today know and do?
Start by tracking your expenses every single day to the penny. I've sat down with clients who are what I call middle-class billionaires, meaning they never inherited a bunch of money, they never made a lot of money, they just saved it. And in one of the common denominators of these people who became financially independent all on their own was that they were very conscious of what they were spending. They didn't, you know, live in the basement and wait to die, but they also were very knowledgeable about where every single penny was going. So by tracking every expense, not only do you find out where it's going, but you figure out what you can cut. Definitely, if you need to borrow money to go to school, borrow the money. It's one of the best reasons to borrow money, but only borrow what you can afford. And remember that payments on those loans will generally be 1% of whatever you borrow per month for 10 years after you get out of school. So if you borrow $40,000, your monthly payments are going to be about $400 per month for 10 years. And as a rule of thumb, you probably shouldn't borrow any more than what your starting gross salary will be after you get out of school. So get into school, but get out with a degree as soon as possible.
Well, I sure hope that we do have some prospective college students listening right now, but I know we have a lot of parents of college students listening right now. What can parents do to help their kids get off on the right financial foot?
It can be kind of a stressful situation because the kid is undertaking something that could cost anywhere from $100,000 to $250,000, and it can be stressful for the parents and the kids to talk about it. But the parents can at least help the kids with that spending plan and say, start tracking your money. I want to see where it's going, and I want you to see where it's going as well. It's okay if the kids screw up a little bit, but nothing that don't let them get into deep trouble as well. You might want to monitor their bank accounts, either online or get access to the accounts as well, especially if you are helping to fund their education. Another step you can take to prevent them from getting into trouble is to freeze their credit report. So not only can they not open up any credit cards that you might not want them to, but also it protects their identity from being stolen as well. You can go to tinyurl.com/cfreeze to find out how to freeze any person's credit report who you have control over or your own. Also, you can go to myfico.com, get the kid's credit score. It costs about $20 per bureau to get the score, but they have a neat little tool there where you not only can show the kid her credit score, but you can demonstrate if she's late on a payment or misses a payment completely or charges too much on a credit card, how that will affect her score and what it will cost in the future, meaning in the form of higher interest rates. And finally, there is a brochure at sallymae.com/FICO, and we'll have links to all these websites at onyourmoney.com later on today. But this is about a 15-page informational guide for kids and parents to work together to try to figure out when to borrow money, when to pay it back as quickly as possible, the terms involved with it, and just let kids know what the potential cost of it might be versus their potential employment and income.
Sounds good. You know, speaking of financial literacy, we are planning on devoting an entire show to helping our listeners become more financial literate. And who am I helping me become more financial
again,
literate?
Again, the only reason you let me come in here. We're going to answer any questions you've always wanted to answer. And this might be about your own situation. We do get a lot of those. But this, you also might say, hey, what does GDP mean? I hear that term, and how is it calculated? What does it mean to my personal life? So any questions like that, or why things behave the way they do, why the stock market might go down when it seems like there's good news in the economy, any questions like that that you want to know about, send them to kevin@onyourmoney.com, and we'll try to answer them on a special show in the future.
Yeah, that'll be great. You can send that to kevin@onyourmoney.com. You can send it to onyourmoney@wpr.org, for that matter. You can post it on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page if you have a financial literacy question that you would like Kevin to answer in an upcoming program. Kevin McKinley is the managing member of McKinley Money LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin does not intend to provide personal investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services discussed are suitable for any investor. Investors should consult with their financial advisors prior to making any investment decisions. If you have a question for Kevin, you can call us at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you can send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. A listener named Maggie emails, and she says, good morning. Would you please tell me what the average fees charged by a financial advisor are? I have about $250,000 in investments and $180,000 in cash from the sale of a home, which needs to be invested. The financial advisor that I consulted quoted me a fee of $350 a month with an annual increase of 1%. Is this a reasonable fee? And thank you very much.
Well, we appreciate the politeness, Maggie. We do appreciate more false praise. So we'll let this one in because it's a very good question. But people out there, if you want your questions answered, remember, false praise moves you right to the top of the heap. If she invests that entire amount with the advisor, she'll end up paying about $4,200 a year in fees on $430,000. And that works out to about 1%. And that is about the average, especially for an account this size. Most financial advisors do charge charge somewhere between 0.5% up to 2 to 2.5%, I've seen in some cases. And they can generally charge what they want within reason. And usually the higher balance you have with that particular advisor, the lower the percentage, but the more the dollars, the actual dollars are that you pay. So this is a reasonable amount.
So is there any way she might be able to reduce that fee?
It's one of the oldest and simplest ways to spend less and have more. Start by asking and say, hey, is there a way that we can still work together and I can pay you less than I'm currently paying you? And she'll either hear what she wants to hear or she'll hear no, and she'll be right back to where she was when she started. She may not want to put all of the money with the advisor if there aren't any minimums. Keep some out of the account, perhaps in, you know, like a certificate of deposit at her local bank or something, and hopefully the advisor can complement that investment with the ones that he or she is putting together for Maggie. And if she's not satisfied with the cost or with the service that she's receiving, she can shop around or she can just do it herself if she wants. And the answer to is a fee reasonable, it's really up to her. Some people would say, hey, $420 is too much to pay for the service. Other people would say $14,000 is a fair rate, depending on what they need, what they're getting, and what they're paying. But if she does choose to pay those investment advisory fees, there is a way that she can actually reduce the effect of that expense.
And how does she do that?
Those fees can be tax deductible, and she does have to itemize, and those fees are added into her miscellaneous itemized deductions. And anything that exceeds 2% of her adjusted gross income, that will then be deductible. For instance, on that $4,200, if she's making less than $50,000 a year or so, about $3,200 of that $4,200 fee will be tax deductible again if she itemizes and throws it into those miscellaneous itemized deductions.
I did not know that, so I learned something new today, as I always
Good,
do.
Good. Let's call it a day.
Yeah, right.
We're ahead.
We will open up the phone lines now for you. If you have a question, a personal finance question for Kevin McKinley, 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Coming up on this edition of On Your Money, Kevin will have some mid-year money moves that all of us can consider. And we'll also hear about a change to a major airline's frequent flyer miles program. That's coming up during On Your Money here on the Ideas Network. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine, along with financial planner Kevin McKinley, with information and advice on your money. If you have a question, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Here's an email from Barbara. She wants to know, Kevin, what is your opinion on purchasing long-term care insurance? Would you recommend it for everyone, or is there a level of assets, like really low or really high, that would make it unnecessary to purchase?
Yeah, that's a great and eternal question, Barbara. As a rule of thumb, you should generally look at long-term care insurance if you have less than more than $200,000 of liquid assets and less than $2 million of liquid assets. And by liquid assets, I mean retirement accounts, savings, investments, etc. If you have less than that, you probably can't afford the premiums, and you're more likely to qualify for Medicaid. If you have more than that, you can probably self-insure. And other than just having the policy in place because it feels good, I wouldn't say that it's something that it's necessary. I would also say it might be a good idea to look at self-insuring if you have a high degree of Social Security and pension income, because by definition, if you're alive and you need the care, those payments are going to be coming in. And those payments are going to help offset the cost of long-term care. I definitely recommend people pursue these policies, look at them. What they're going to find, though, is that they tend to be very expensive, and you can usually plan on spending at least $200 per month per person, and the rates are going to be going up in the future, even if you lock in a policy today, because the long-term care insurance companies generally are finding that they underpriced this coverage many years ago, and People are hanging on to the policies longer, which means more people are keeping the coverage, and they're living longer as well, and the cost is going up. And so the insurance companies are struggling to cover that. So if you buy it, go ahead, feel good. Great, good for you. But many people buy this when they're, say, 60, hoping that it pays off when they're 85, and they don't know if they're going to need it, what kind of care they'll need, and the insurance company can't explicitly guarantee that they will be in place to cover every single entity. So I definitely advise you to look at it, but just be very cautious. You may be disappointed with what you find.
Thanks, Barbara, for the email. Now we go to the phones. Sally in La Crosse joins us. Hi, Sally.
Hi. Hello, did you want my question?
No, yes, I do. I'm just teasing, Sally. We do want your question. What is it for Kevin?
Okay, I am 76 years old, recently widowed, and I have about 200 in combined retirement accounts, and I get adequate amount of monthly expenses, paid off home, paid off car, and my question is, could I be giving, I have five children, should I be giving them some money every year out of that $200 retirement? I hate to have it just sitting there, and I do not have a lot of expenses, or, you know, I don't really need that much money.
And Sally, right. I think she said $200.
Yeah, $200,000. Yeah, and Sally, yeah. First of all, I'm sorry for your loss. I'm glad you're asking this question, though, because it is an eternal question for people who do want to help their kids. Should I give it to them now or leave it to them later? I think you sound very strong and very healthy. My guess is you're going to live a long time, and the longer you live, Sally, the more likely it is that you will need that money. As a rule of thumb, when you're talking about giving money away to people, to friends, family members, to a charity, whatever, if you say, what's a fair amount that I can either spend or give away of this pot, if you will, I'd say it's probably about 1/200th of it every single month. And that divides out nicely. It means that you have about $1,000 as a rule of thumb that you can give away or spend or use it to help somebody else out. I applaud giving money away when a little bit now versus a lot later. Let's say you live to be 96. $1,000 today to your kids will probably mean as much to them as $10,000 will 20 years from now. But I would just be cautious about giving away too much just because, like I said, you're going to live a long time, I think, and it's more like you need the money. And most kids would say, hey, Mom or Dad, you know, you keep it. I want you to enjoy it and have it be there for you in case you do need it for an emergency. But it can be more enjoyable, and especially if they're going through some kind of trouble, financial trouble. Help them out by giving them a month's worth of expenses. Say if you say to them, you know, we lost our job, we're having a hard time paying for things. Let's say, tell you what, tell me how much you're spending in a month, and I'll give you that amount of money right now, and then a month from now, let's circle back and see how things are going. And that's a way to help them out, get through the month, alleviate some of the stress, but then also not just give them a huge lump sum that they may spend in ways you wouldn't prefer that they do.
And Sally, I'm so glad you called in and had the courage to call in. You know, calling in is a scary thing to do, Kevin.
Yes,
it's scary for me to show up every day. I don't know how,
right.
I do it.
And I didn't mean to. I was just teasing you about that. Did you have a follow-up?
Well, no, except our five children do all have college educations and are working. And I did give them some money. And they said, what are you doing? They really don't need it. But I just don't want to. I'd rather have them have it when I'm here. And I am healthy. But I don't care to travel anymore a lot, you know, big trips or anything. So I can't foresee that I would spend this money.
Yeah, you just never know. And the fact that they're saying, what are you doing? Why are you doing this? is a great sign for them. They sound like a wonderful group of kids. Just be very cautious. A few hundred dollars here and there is fine. Absolutely no problem with that at all. Anything more than that, I'd just rather have you hang on to it, make sure it's there when you need it.
Thank you, Sally, for calling in, and good luck to you. We have another caller in La Crosse, Christine in La Crosse. Hi, go ahead with your question for Kevin.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. My question is regarding retirement. Currently, I'm 28 years old, and what's the best strategy to kind of better understand, you know, how much am I going to be spending once I reach retirement age, and then kind of working backwards, you know, how much should I be saving to reach that goal? And how do we really know how much, you know, we're going to be spending once we retire, you know, considering inflation and all the other factors that go into that?
Yep, absolutely. Christine, for better or for worse, inflation is probably not going to be a huge issue in retirement for things that you want to spend money on. It's the things that you need to spend money on, like healthcare, that generally will be going up in cost. As a rule of thumb, you need probably 200 times your net monthly expenses in retirement in savings. So if you're spending $5,000 a month and you are expecting to get Social Security, and Social Security will be there for you in some shape or form when you retire. But if you're expecting to spend $5,000 a month in retirement and Social Security, let's say, is going to be $2,000, that leaves $3,000 per month in retirement that you need to cover from your own savings. And 200 times that amount is $600,000. And it sounds like a lot of money, especially if you're 28. But if you save $5,000 to $10,000 per year just in a Roth IRA, even if it grows at a hypothetical rate of, say, 6 to 7% per year, which if you invest aggressively enough, that's a reasonable figure, you will actually get to that $600,000 amount and beyond. So what I would try to do is at least save $5,000 per person per year. Now, if you're in a high-income bracket, the best way to do that is through a pre-tax plan at work, like a 401k or a 403b. If you're in a low-tax bracket, use the Roth IRA because you don't get a tax break on the contributions, but you can pull those contributions back out whenever you want with no taxes or penalties at any time. So it serves as kind of an ersatz savings account, if you will, for emergencies. And if you don't need it, great, it'll be there for retirement.
Thanks for the call, Christine. Next we go to Eileen in Watertown. Hello, Eileen, you're on the air.
Good morning. I'm calling because I work in a financial aid office, and Kevin, thank you for your comments about parents and students working together. The big one that we see, though, is the parents trying to call in to find out about their students' financial aid status. And unfortunately, we have the law sort of like with health care called FERPA. And I would just encourage parents to call in with their students so that we can share the information with both of them. Mm-hmm. And so that the student, like you said, starts to take that responsibility for knowing where their financial aid is and what it is and those types of things.
And is that for real, Eileen? It's called FERPA?
Yes, it's called the Family Education Responsibility Protection Act. It's sort of like HIPAA in the health care field.
That's funny because we have a joke about that when people ask me, do you work with Bill Berditzman? I know him. He said he's your financial advisor. I said, I'm sorry, due to FIPA, I can't talk about other people's money to other people. But I'm glad to know there's actually a real law like that. And Eileen, I love the fact that you called in. Thank you so much, because people in the financial aid office are overwhelmed right now with trying to arrange money for all these people. And you're getting in the middle of parents and basically teenagers in most cases. And it could be a very stressful situation. And there is so much information that financial aid people want other people to know about this. And it's such a narrow window of opportunity. You know, if you're talking about retirement, we have 40 years to save for retirement, and you have 20 or 30 years to spend it. But most people only save for college if they do save maybe 5 or 10 years, and then it's usually spent within 4 or 5 years, and they usually don't have enough to cover the whole thing. So, yes, that's very, very good advice, Eileen, and you do hero's work, so thank you very much.
Yes, Eileen, thanks for the call. I'm Joy Cardine, along with Kevin McKinley. Kevin is a financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, here to answer your personal finance questions. If you have one for him, 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. It is time now for Smart Assets. And with only a few months left in the year, now's a good time to start making some time-sensitive money moves. So what are some of these money moves we should consider, Kevin?
Sorry to tell you, people, there are only 4.5 months left in the calendar year for 2015. Most of these moves are about cutting your taxes either now or in the future or both. But also, you need to watch out for some dangers ahead if you don't get some things done by the end of the year.
So where do we start?
Well, as we just mentioned to the caller from La Crosse, workers should boost their contribution to their at-work retirement plan. This, again, is a 401k or a 403b if they can afford to. The limits are $18,000 if you're under 50 and $24,000 if you're over 50, or your earnings, your gross earnings, whichever are less. And at least boost your contributions up enough to get the match. Financial Engines just released the results of a survey, and they said about a quarter of workers do not even get their employer match. That's free money that they're leaving on the table, and it's about an average of 1,300 hours per year per worker that people should be getting in their 401ks, and they're not. Plus, every single dollar you put into a pre-tax retirement plan cuts your taxes next April from anywhere from 10 to 40 cents, depending on the tax bracket in which you fall. If you are concerned about bumping up your contributions to the pre-tax plan, about the loss of income, try living off your savings. If you do have some savings set aside, it's smarter to spend that savings now to cover basic monthly expenses and then get the tax break as well.
All right, so that's for workers. Anything for workers and retirees alike?
Yeah, again, take a look at your potential tax bracket. If it's high, meaning if it's over 15% for the federal bracket, if you bump up to the 25% federal income tax bracket, sell any investments you have that have a loss right now, and then itemize any deductions that you possibly can as well. If you're below that amount, and especially if you're well below it, you may want to convert some of your IRAs to Roth IRAs, and you might pay a little bit in taxes now, but then you're done paying taxes on that forever, and there's no mandatory distribution on those at 70 and a half. If you have any positions outside of retirement accounts that have made money for you, you may want to sell those. You may qualify for a 0% long-term capital gains tax rate. And finally, if you don't have many deductions this year, take the standard tax deduction now and try to bunch your deductions next year so you can itemize and get a bigger break that way.
Are there things that we should be watching out for right now?
Absolutely. If you take a loss on an investment, meaning you sell a loser in your portfolio, and again, it has to be outside of your retirement account, you cannot rebuy that security for 30 days after or before the sale. Also, if you're reinvesting in new mutual funds between now and the end of the year, watch out, because many of these, especially stock-based mutual funds, may distribute capital gains and income between now and the end of the year that you will be liable for, even though you didn't actually make the profit off of. So if you're buying funds outside of a retirement account, be very cautious of that. And then finally, as we mentioned, make sure you take those required minimum distributions at 70 and a half and beyond. And not only does that account for IRAs, but also inherited IRAs. IRAs have been around now for, you know, almost 40 years, and so many people have inherited IRAs from parents or loved ones or whatever, and they don't realize that they have to take required minimum distributions out of those every single year as well. And if you've missed the required minimum distribution, there can be a 50% excise tax on whatever you were supposed to take out but did not.
I think we're in trouble there, too. Oh, well.
Joy dashes out of the studio.
We have a caller who I think has a money move issue that he wants to ask about. John in Gordon. Hi, John.
Good morning, Joy, and good morning, Kevin. I am seeking your brilliant commentary.
There we go. Very good.
Came to the right place.
Regarding the required minimum distributions, earlier in the year, and perhaps even last year, you referred to a law that was passed by the Congress on an annual basis, and it would provide an opportunity for a required minimum distribution to be earmarked for a given charity, and that would not preclude my claiming my standard deduction on my 1040. Now, I would like to know what that law is called. I would like to know if, in fact, it has been passed for tax year 2015 for required minimum distribution. How would one go about dealing with that?
No, you just call into the show. and that you've taken the first big step already for it, John. Good question. This is a weird law, and what it does is it allows people to donate money from their IRAs, and they can donate it tax-free to a qualified charity without having to itemize. Otherwise, if you don't itemize and you donate the amount, it's technically taxable income, and that can affect your taxes not only from the donation amount, but also it can then make your Social Security taxable and can have other penalties. For some reason, Congress keeps renewing this on a year-to-year basis, and so far we have not heard that it for sure will be available in 2015. It was for 2014, but I'm assuming it will be, and what I would do is contact the charity now who you intend to donate donate the money to. They will be very happy to hear from you, and just tell them what you're thinking about doing, and then you can get on their radar. They will know more about this law as it comes to fruition before the end of the year, if it's renewed, than you probably will, because it's a big source of revenue for them. And so I would contact them and say, I'm thinking about doing this. What are the steps I should take right now to get the paperwork in place so that if and when this is renewed and approved, it's already good to go? And if it doesn't come to fruition, then so be it. You don't have to actually make the donation. But if it does, you'll be very glad you have all that stuff, all the groundwork in place.
Sound good, John?
Do you know what the name of the law is?
They call it charitable donations from IRAs. No congressperson has been smart enough to put his or her name on top of it, but it's generally just a charitable donation from IRA law.
All right, John. Thanks for the call. We have John in Oshkosh with us now. Hi, John.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call, Joy. Great show.
Thank you.
And Bill, it was always a pleasure listening to you. Your information is always interesting and sometimes applicable.
I'll just settle for one out of the three.
my question, my wife and I, we both have 401ks, and we take full advantage of company-sponsored savings plans, and so does my brother and his wife. And our father is retired. He is looking to rent a condominium, and the lack of real estate in our own portfolios made us think, why don't we purchase a condo between the two of our families, my wife and I, and my brother and his wife, and have my father rent it from us as a real estate portion of our portfolio. What are the tax ramifications with that, and does that sound like a smart idea?
The tax ramifications, you're going to get more headache and paperwork than you are going to get actual tax benefits from it, but it's not the dumbest idea in the world. Plus, look at it this way. If he ever says anything unfortunate to you at Christmas, Dad, I'd hate to evict you. Why don't you just,
right.
I don't want to hear your political views right now, okay?
The upshot of it was at the end of maybe it's a 10 or 15-year loan, at the end of that time period, we just have an asset that we didn't pay for.
That hopefully he paid for. And it depends on, you have to charge market rates for these types of things. Otherwise, whatever you don't charge is actually a gift to him. And there should be no gift tax on it as long as it's not more than $14,000 per year per person. And it sounds like you all get along relatively well.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, I think if that's the case, what I would do, though, is I would have everything on paper. No handshake agreements or anything. I want to have the ownership very, very strictly documented. I want the rental agreement and everything. I mean, the IRS likes that a lot better than just, he pays us when he can, and we sort of own it together. And are you going to pay cash for the condo? Are you going to try to borrow the money or what?
We'll probably put the normal 15-20% down and then take a loan out on the rest.
Okay, that might be, I think that's a good idea. I think you might have an issue there because you have different parties, but I would talk to a lender and just explain what you're doing. It's not the weirdest thing they've heard, and they'll either say yes or no, and then you can decide to proceed with them or pay cash for it yourself. But no, I think that it can be a very good idea, and it's a nice way to hopefully support him, maybe give him a little break on the rent as well.
Yeah, good luck, John. What a nice thing to do. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley. Kevin is a financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money LLC. We will talk about frequent flyer miles programs coming up, and then there's time for more of your questions. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network. Was one of my favorite songs a while back. I'm Joy Cardine. This is On Your Money. Financial planner Kevin McKinley is here to answer your questions. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Talking about that jet plane because a major airline is tweaking its frequent flyers miles program, which makes this a good time to review all of your reward options. So what airline is changing what, Kevin?
Well, the airline business is very good. Their fuel prices are generally low. And if you've flown lately, you know that their planes are generally full, and that means that they are getting more stingy on their mileage programs. Delta Airlines just announced another change, that you will now need more miles for popular flights. And earlier, they had changed the way that you're going to earn the miles. It's going to be based on the cost of the ticket, of what you actually pay for it. So you pay more for the ticket, you get more miles. You pay less, you get less. Other airlines have followed suit and will be doing so. And it really is just supply and demand. They're making these changes because they realize they don't have to give away these seats anymore. They're making it harder to get more miles and spend less to get the flight that you want.
Well, that's irritating. What are some of the new rules of thumb when it comes to earning and redeeming these points and miles?
The value of the mile is usually about a penny or less. So be careful about going out of your way to earn certain miles, and especially if you have to spend more money to get those particular miles. And the seats may not be available when you expect to use those miles, and you may be better off just paying cash, not only for things that you were paying for, try to earn miles for, but then also just paying cash for the seat. If you do have miles building up, you want to redeem them sooner instead of waiting. As a rule of thumb, these miles are declining in value every single day, so this is a good reason to take that trip that you've been putting off for too long.
I'm going to do that. So are there which rewards programs are the most flexible?
IdeaWorks, which is a Wisconsin-based company, studied thousands and thousands of flights to figure out which airlines offered the greatest percentage of their seats for people trying to redeem miles. Southwest Airlines came out on top, and JetBlue and United also did very well. Delta and American did the worst in the survey. In some cases, only half of the seats available were applicable to mile redemption. But it does depend on the actual lead time when you're actually booking the site, and it depends also on the credit card maybe that you've used to accumulate those miles in the first place.
Yeah, so what credit cards are best for racking up miles?
There are two that generally stand out. Discover Card has some of the most flexible and highest earning options, and then Capital One has a rewards card as well, which also gets high marks for its terms and earning the most miles quickest. But you have to watch out for the fees and the charges and the interest rates versus the current card that you're using, because they try to get you that way by giving you more miles and then end up charging you more on those whatsoever. And creditcards.com does have a very nice listing of the best rewards cards are out there. Again, creditcards.com, and we'll put that up at onyourmoney.com. But again, at a penny per mile, the fees can really add up. We had a question recently about someone saying, hey, I've got one card that gives me rewards, but there's another one that gives more rewards, but there is a $59 fee per year versus no fee. Well, we figured out at a penny per mile, it takes about 6,000 extra miles on the other card that you'd need to earn every single year just to offset the annual fee, and that doesn't include higher interest charges or other fees you might incur.
I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley. This is On Your Money. Kevin McKinley, financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, is here just about every week at this time with information and advice on your money. We have an open line for you at 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Daniel in Viola is with us now. Hi, Daniel.
Hey, Joy. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, thanks for calling in.
Yeah, absolutely. And Kevin, I really appreciate the show. This pertains to me as I'm an entering freshman college student. So my question is, I have most of my college expenses covered by university grants and scholarships, and the remainder I have offset by summer income and savings. But additionally, I have about $10,000 in a savings account that I don't expect to be using all of it. And I'm wondering what your advice is on investing that, if it's a good idea to potentially invest it in like a Roth IRA or something. What are your guys' thoughts?
Well, my first thought, Daniel, is how old are you?
I'm 19.
19, okay. You're already smarter than us, much less how old we were at 19. I was like, even though I was fairly, I should say, financially advanced for a 19-year-old, I was still like, well, let's see, it's $6 for a large pizza. Okay, if we divide that four ways, well, let's divide it two ways and get two pizzas. Oh, let's just get a large.
$10,000 in a savings account already.
Nice job, Daniel. Yeah. You're doing very well. And I'm sorry, did you say you were working, you have earned income?
Okay. I have a summer job, and I'm expecting to earn between maybe $5,000 and $6,000, and that will cover my first year expenses at Princeton.
Yep. Princeton.
There we go.
Okay. I actually have more questions for you, Danielle. What is life? Tell me what I need to know. What you want to do is use that Roth IRA that you mentioned, and you can put in up to $5,500 or your earnings, whichever is less, for that Roth IRA. You can do it right now for the 2015 tax year, but you can also wait as long as to April 15th and make the contribution for the 2015 year at that time. And again, with the Roth IRA, the great benefit of it is you do not get a tax break on it. But because you're in a relatively low income tax bracket, that's no big deal. I bet you're going to be in a high tax bracket when you retire. And at that point, the Roth IRA distributions will be tax-free. And in the meantime, if you need that money for an emergency or to further your education or whatever, you can pull the contributions back out at any time for any reason with no taxes or penalties whatsoever. And in terms of what kind of fund you want to use for that Roth IRA, it's hard to say for sure. But if you really feel like, no, this is a long-term deal, I would look at something called a target fund. And Vanguard is one of the largest low-cost providers of target date funds. And how those work is they start out with a very aggressive asset allocation right now, and then a year in which you choose, usually in increments of 5 years. So you might choose, let's say, the 2060 target date fund. As you get older and as that year draws closer, the fund will gradually become more conservative. It doesn't mean that you won't lose money in it. The value can still go down because there's a lot of stock-based mutual funds in the account. But that's a nice thing to just use to focus on it being a long-range goal. But you can still pull it out whenever you want, as long as you're just pulling out the contributions. Again, no taxes or penalties.
Okay, awesome. So Vanguard with a 55-year target date?
Yep, something that's going to coincide when you think you will probably need the money. Again, it's not going to be a perfect linear move upward, but it's a good thing to contribute to. And if you just do $5,000 a year, and again, at 7%, so you're probably, in 40 years, you're probably looking at, I think it works out to close to $1 million by the time you turn 60.
So any idea, Daniel, what field you'll be retiring from when you retire?
Absolutely no idea.
Good. That's a good,
good
person like you should keep your options open.
Wonderful. Good luck to you. Thank you so much for the call. Greg called, and he said he has two Edvest accounts for his kids, and he's wondering if he can transfer money from one account to the other.
Oh, no. He's mad at one of his kids, isn't he?
You know, he's not going to...
Cain and Abel, sibling rivalry.
He's not going to fund that one's education.
I'd use that as a threat, even if you're not actually going to make the transfer. Yeah, he definitely can. Just contact Edvest and say, I want to move the accounts from one kid to another. Generally, there's just a form to sign off on that, but no, as long as they're siblings, he should be able to do that without any significant issues.
All right, let's go to Victor in West Dallas. Hi, Victor.
Hi, Joyce. Hey, Kevin, I got a question. My wife and I, we have no children. And now, I've heard that it's called living trust or death trust. What we want to do is we're getting our wills updated. We would like to donate a lot of our money to Wisconsin Public Radio, plus, you know, the Humane Society and the Marine and Navy Relief Fund. Hmm. How can one go about doing that? Do you have to die first before you can give it, or is there another way to give it?
No, you can give it while you're alive if you want, and you get a tax deduction on that depending on the size of the gift and your situation. And But you can also make any charity, including Wisconsin Public Radio, the beneficiary of a particular account. Some people make the IRA beneficiaries. They name a charity there, so then it'll go tax-free to the charity rather than it being a person, because then if it goes to a person, it's taxable income when that person pulls the money out of it. And the neat thing about that is not that you would ever change your mind after you choose to donate money to Wisconsin Public Radio, but you can do that. When you just name a charity as the beneficiary, you can at any given moment call the IRA custodian and say, you know what, I'm not crazy about them anymore. I want to change the allocation, cross it off, and they'll go ahead and do that for you. And as long as you are still alive, you can make that change whenever you feel like. I would definitely contact the charity in question, though, and say, here's what I'd like to do. Again, they will love to hear from you. And depending on when and how much, there are a lot of different ways you can do this. It'll provide you tax advantages right now and or after you're gone.
Yeah, we're retired, so we don't spend a lot of money, you know, so we can't itemize or anything like that. We just kind of live low-key,
mm-hmm.
you know.
No, and that's the key to being financially independent and being able to have money to do whatever you want with it, including giving some or all of it away at some point.
Okay, well, thank you very much. Enjoy your program as you enjoy it, okay?
Yeah, thank you, Victor.
Thank you very much, Victor. And I hope we don't make you mad.
No, gosh, because the helicopter that brought me into the studio today, I've noticed one of the rotors was a little rusty, and I was concerned about it. So, yeah, we really did.
You can take my car home.
We do joke about that, about chauffeurs and jets and helicopters. Let me tell you, your money that you are kind enough to give to Wisconsin Public Radio is not being spent on amenities at all. The luxurious fixtures here count as like a clean coffee pot.
And, that's right.
And so they're very...
And we don't have that.
And we don't have a clean coffee pot here. So anything you give goes right to help make this station and network better for the listener.
Yeah, and you know, maybe down the road we can talk a little bit more about charitable giving, and I'm sure we will.
Yep.
I know that Kevin and I were on a panel not that long ago talking about charitable giving and living trusts and that sort of stuff. Let's go. Jim in Cedarburg sent an email. Should gold or silver be a part of a retirement portfolio? How does one secure it and hold it?
Yeah, that's a little tricky because depending on the form of the gold or silver, you can't just put the bars in an IRA per se. It's possible to do that. Some custodians will actually hold bars or coins or collectibles, but it's very difficult to do that. A better proxy is probably to buy a mutual fund that invests in gold and silver or represents the rise and fall in silver. But again, for better or for worse, you don't actually own the coins or the metal yourself. And some people like to have this type of metal in their portfolio as not as an investment, but as almost like a panic relief, meaning say, well, I've got $20,000 in gold. If it all goes completely haywire, I've still got this gold. And by having it in paper form, it might not be as reassuring. You might want to buy it outside of it and just keep the coins in a safe, accessible place next to your guns and your freeze-dried packs. You put it all in your Wisconsin Public Radio tote bag.
All right, well, it's time for the website of the week.
Oh, this is a good one. Coming up on Yellow Pages season. And according to the good people at the Product Stewardship Institute, 650 million tons of Yellow Pages phone books will be dropped on our doorsteps over the
year.
On
mine alone.
I know. Thud. There's another one just as we speak of it. And because of the ubiquity of online search, people just don't use these phone books anymore, and they really are advertising vehicles, let's be honest about it. And I still let my fingers do the walking once in a while. But if you don't and you don't want to have this phone book dropped on your doorstep, the people at the Product Stewardship Institute say that $60 million per year is spent collecting, recycling, and disposing of unwanted or unused phone books. Go to yellowpagesoptout.com. You put in your zip code and you click on the different directories in your area that are going to be dropped off. And by registering there, hopefully they'll be able to avoid putting in there. And again, like a lot of these registries, it's not perfect. It doesn't mean for sure that it will be avoided, but it's a good way to hopefully prevent it from actually happening. Yellowpagesoptout.com, and we'll put a link up to that website at our website onyourmoney.com later on today.
That's a good idea. I mean, I take the one that's on the porch, or one of the ones that is on the porch, replace the one in the drawer, and then all the rest.
It's a tradition in the Cardine household.
Yeah. All right. Four more words before we go.
Spend less, have more.
Kevin McKinley, financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money LLC, and he will be back next week with another edition of On Your Money. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.